a matter of perhaps nuance, but it is important. I was discussing on Monday the principle of programmed music, and as your lectures should make clear, fundamental to that defining characteristic is the composer's intentions. You will recall my observing that we all, at one time or another, depending upon our sophistication and frame of mind at a particular point, we all will attribute to instrumental music some extra musical meaning. We will hear in it some image, we will call to mind some personal experience that shapes that image. We will impose upon it a story, a narrative, what have you. That does not make music program music. What makes a composition program music is when the composer has expressly intended that instrumental music to convey a narrative, to tell a story, to recount an experience or a stream of thought. And we know this because the composer has accompanied the composition with a text that winds up in the concert program for the audience's benefit. They read the text, they listen to the music, presumably they draw the right conclusions about what particular episodes mean. That is program music. So what is the distinction between a symphonic poem or tone poem that is the principal orchestral genre of program music in the 19th century, and a character piece? The difference is between a photograph and a film. Think of it in those analogous terms. If we consider, for example, an early example of character piece, that by Fanny Mendelssohn Henslow that you encountered in listening assignment number 5, you will observe that Opus 2, number 2, has this descriptive title, September on the River. And you will recall the flowing, indeed virtuosic, character of that music that is, in fact, intended clearly to capture the notion of a flowing stream. What makes it September is obviously a matter of imagination. There's nothing necessarily autumnal about that music, but it certainly flows. Nobody would dispute that. Let us consider other examples of character pieces in later period. Page 72 of the Gold Book takes us to assignment 9, Music of the Post-Romantic Period. And while at the bottom of the page, you have reference, of course, to a symphonic poem based upon German folk tale about a mischievous, antisocial individual who threatens the establishment and ultimately pays the price for his seemingly antisocial behavior. On the next page, you are introduced in Claude Debussy's repertory to character pieces, not only keyboard character pieces, specifically Footsteps in the Snow from his Preludes Book 1, and Voile, Preludes, also Preludes Book 1. But we have an orchestral character piece in Nuage, one of 3 nocturnes for orchestra. Notice that, trois nocturnes. The term nocturne is a label for character piece. Chopin composed nocturnes, you heard one. This character piece, however, is not simply for piano, it is for orchestra. Nuage, as you can see, or not see, but would hear in the narrative, means clouds. So what Debussy was doing is evoking the movement of clouds in this character piece, and you will note, as you listen to it again, that while there's all this motion There's no sense of forward direction or climax at the end. Clouds change their shape, they move through the sky. If you happen to miss one cloud, there's always another one coming along, so don't worry about it. But there is no narrative text. There is no story. Character pieces invite us to form images, but they don't invite us to create a story. That's what the composer does. You probably use it. Is that distinction clear? Are there any questions about that distinction? Is it clear? Yes, Mr. Reed.
I was going to say, so they, exactly what you said, they create imagery, but they don't tell a story.
Right. They invite the image. But they don't tell a story. Program music claims to tell a story. This is clear enough that you'd be asked to explain, to compare and contrast a character piece and a symphonic poem. You could do so. What do they have in common? What do character pieces and symphonic poems have in common? Yes, Ms. Wright. Your name, right? Two, yeah. Right. What do they have in common? Who knows what they have in common? Just the root.
They both depict something that's more than just music.
Yes. They both have or assume an extra musical connection. Extra, in this case, being outside. They both reach out to the non-music. That's what they do have in common. In the case of a character piece, a descriptive title. In the case of symphonic poem, a text. That's what they have in common. But the difference is, as Mr. Lee indicated, one invites an image, the other suggests an unfolding. Clear? Clear? Thank you. All right. Now, while we have this numerous examples of character pieces, and we have numerous examples of program music, not all does well, shall we say, in Europe. That is to say, not everybody bought into the notion that instrumental music could tell a story or suggest a stream of conscious thought. And indeed, some felt that to impose such a direction, directed listening on the audience was an insult. Don't tell me what to think about this music. I don't do that, thank you. You don't need to do that, just write it. And make sure it's good music. Because don't believe for a moment that mediocre music in support of a story or program is going to fly. Lousy music is lousy music, and no text is going to save it. Any more than a good song lyric is going to prop up a lousy melody. And we discover the beginnings of at times an intense debate between those who believe that instrumental music, orchestral music, not only could but should serve a program, and those who thought it couldn't, let alone should. So, we have composers like Hector Berlioz, Franz Liszt, Bedřich Smetana, Richard Strauss, Jean Sibelius, all composing music that was programmatic. Berlioz, among the earliest with his Symphonie Fantastique, of 1829. Liszt coming along in the 1850s with his poems. Smetana in the 1870s. Strauss in the 1880s and 90s and early part of the 20th century. Sibelius, likewise, in the 1880s and 90s and first part of the 20th century, writing symphonic poems of one sort or another. Or symphonies, in the case of Verdi. But by contrast, composers like Felix Mendelssohn, Robert Schumann, Johannes Brahms, composed symphonies with no such narratives. Brahms never wrote a symphonic poem in his career, nor did Schumann. Now, among the earliest criticisms of the concept of program music, just the notion of program music, came from the pen of Schumann in the year 1835. You will recall my saying that among his many other activities, Schumann was a critic of music and indeed established a journal, the Neue Zeitschrift für Musik, the new musical journal. He wished to publish and disseminate his opinions about what good music was and what mediocre compositions were, and so forth. You'll recall my quoting from it when he said that nothing significant had happened in music since the death of Beethoven at one point, talking about art song. Berlioz's Symphony Fantastique, as I said, dated from the year 1829. It's one of the performed in Paris for the first time. But it did not make its way into Germany until the mid-1830s. You know, there were no recordings, there was no radio, it was going to be performed, and orchestra's conductor had to program it. And this did not happen in Schumann's neck of the woods until the mid-1830s. And he wrote a critical essay about the world. And he comes to discussing Berlioz's program. You have a portion of that program that is for the final movement of the Symphony Fantastique in your score anthology on page 159. You might take notes to review that, because this is what Schumann says. He says, thus the program. All Germany is happy to let him keep it. All Germany is happy to let Berlioz keep his program. Such signposts always have something unworthy and charlatan-like about them. In any case, the five titles would have been enough. Each of Berlioz's movements had its own title, the one you have heard, which is Sabbath. But the beginning of Dreams and Reveries, then the second movement is called The Ball, Ball, and so forth. Word of mouth would have served to hand down a more circumstantial account, which would certainly arouse interest because of the personality of the composer who lived through the events of the symphony himself. You will recall that Berlioz's Symphony Fantastique was inspired by his own evolving attachment to a British actress named Harriet Smithson. The unfortunate part of the story is they did indeed marry and find a song they had absolutely nothing in common with one another. Much of them were rushing to do that. Schumann goes on to say, in a word, the German, with his delicacy of feeling and his aversion to personal revelation, dislikes having his thoughts so rudely directed. Schumann is saying this program is telling us how to listen, telling us how to think, and we don't like that. I like the notion of the Germans with delicacy of feeling. I don't think any people have a corner on delicacy of feeling, perfect. Let me repeat that and continue the sentence. In a word, the German, with his delicacy of feeling and his aversion to personal revelations, dislikes having his thoughts so rudely directed. He was already offended by Beethoven that Beethoven should not trust him to divine the sense of the pastoral symphony without assistance. Now, you recall the big band has played the pastoral symphony this year. You recall the program lists the five movements with their various titles. Seen by the Brook is the second movement, and the Thunderstorm is the third, and the Happy Thoughts After the Thunderstorm's Passed is the final movement, and so forth. Schumann saying, we didn't even need that. Call it symphony in B flat major, B2, and give us the five movements. We don't need even those descriptive titles. It's offensive. You're telling us what to think. From the very beginning of the whole advent of program music, the rise of Berlioz, we have an objection to being told how to listen. And while Schumann's complaint of 1835 was essentially that a program offends listeners, at least German listeners, tells them more than they need to know, and deprives them of their own imaginations, the use of their own imagination, and making sense out of the composition. Later critics of program music made an argument that was more radical. It's not a case of offending the listener now. They went to the root of the notion of what music's powers are. And this opposition to program music became more vocal at the middle of the century, when we are leaving the Romantic period and moving into the post-Romantic period of European art. And one of the most articulate and vehement opponents of program music was Eduard Hanslick, a Viennese critic, music critic, Viennese, not German, not in Germany where Schumann resided, but in Austro-Hungarian capital, Vienna. And Hanslick was quite adamant about this. As a point of information, Hanslick was also a friend of Brahms. Hanslick befriended Antonin Dvořák later on. And in 1854, Hanslick published an essay, a lengthy scholarly essay, called, as you can see, Vom musikalischen Schönen, on the beautiful in music, 1854. This was his rebuttal of those who were talking about the virtues of orchestral music and the power of orchestral music to tell stories without the aid of a singer or narrator right there before you. His argument against program music has several elements. The first, a composer expresses ideas that are purely musical in nature. His imagination conceives a definite and graceful melody aimed at nothing beyond itself. Music for its own sake. Melody for their own sake. It probably, I assume, never occurred to any of you to say, well, what does a Mozart string quartet mean? What does a Haydn piano sonata mean? Yet, we are now, by now, in our location in history, often prepared to say, well, what does that one movement orchestral composition by Franz Liszt trying to say? Hanslick says a true composer is only interested in music for its own sake. This is his second assumption, and it is a powerful one. Definite feelings and emotions are not capable of being embodied in music. Now that's abstract, and I'll flesh it out for you once you take note of it. Because he goes on to explain what he means by this seemingly obscure. And this is his. Love is a definite emotion. I think we'll agree. Nobody in this room, while they may have various experiences with this emotion, Nobody in this room would deny it is an emotional state, right? To be in love is an emotional state. Yes. Anybody dissent from that? Anybody disagree that to be in love is an emotional state? All right, good. I didn't think there would be, but I just want to get these facts set up on the line. He goes on to say that that love, that emotional state, may be gentle or impetuous, buoyant or depressed, and yet it remains love. Let's consider, for example, the opening of Ishtadeva. The poet talks about being in the month of May, the flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and he has love for this young woman whom he obviously has not expressed this to. And then in the second poem, he tentatively expresses it, nervously, clearly. And then in the third poem, we know by his impetuous outburst, you always have to be the etc., that he has been rewarded with her positive response to his pursuit at the time. And nothing, if not impetuous, would describe the meaning of that song, that third song. Go back and listen to it if you can't call it to mind. Love has many forms, is what he's saying in the sentence. This reflection alone ought to make it clear that music can only express those adjectives and not the noun. Music can sound impetuous. Music can be gentle, and it is. Music can be buoyant. Music can seem somber and depressed. Consider Funeral March from the First Symphony of Gustav Mahler, as an example of that, the children's song that we know as Clara Jacka, that the Germans knew, Austrians knew, Blue Dev Mountain, in a minor key. Obviously somber. But music can be buoyant, can sound somber, can be gentle, can be somber impetuous. Music cannot express love. An instrumental composition, you know, somebody go to the piano and improvise, it's improvised love for me. Go ahead, after do your best. Love. Unambiguous, not impetuous because of the fact that the basketball team is going to New York, but impetuous because of love. Not depressed because the basketball team didn't go to the NCAA. Depressed because of love. See what I mean? See what he's saying? Is that clear? You can express not the specific emotion, not the noun, love. You can't express in musical terms the adjectives, the effects.
How can it do that?
How can it? The sum of buoyant, gentle, impetuous, and depressed, the sum of those does not equal love. One could be gentle, impetuous, buoyant, or depressed because one just got a raise. Because one's been admitted to the graduate school of one's choice. Because one has been accepted to compete in a national competition. Right? Yes, Mr. Lee.
Isn't that what they're trying to do with program music?
What they are trying to do, if we read the programs, is express something as literal as love.
Through using adjectives.
Yes, but the conclusion that you're supposed to reach is that they're expressing love.
And you did.
Only if you have the program. The music by itself cannot. I would be happy to demonstrate this for you. Okay? But I just want to make sure that the principle is clear, realizing that the demonstration might make it clear. But is this point clear to you? You can express not emotional states, but the resulting feeling, effect from the emotional state. And many emotional, different emotional states can lead to the same adjective. Here, I'll give you one. the death of a member of your family with whom you are very close. Your significant other suddenly telling you that he or she doesn't care for you anymore. Would you not agree that those would induce feelings of depression, of loss? Now, your musical composition suggests specifically, oh, he's depressed because the significant other is out of it, versus he's depressed because my favorite aunt died. Edward Hanslick said, no, I can't do that. You can have a program that tells you that, but that's going back to the criticism of telling the listener what to think. The listener engages with the music purely as music, which is what composers intend. You can't get to that kind of specificity. It's simply impossible. So let's consider. Play your two excerpts. You tell me which is programmatic music and which is the alternative, which Bonds points out was a term coined by Richard Wagner, absolute music. Music without any non-musical reference. Music without any extra musical meaning, because music for its own sake.
Absent
that, that prior engagement.
Well, if I just heard from something officer without anything, I would just say it's a bunch of food plan.
I think we all would. And likely so. We haven't been prompted, have we? We haven't been told how to listen to us. And I realize it's difficult to sort of take back that sense of awareness and imagine yourself before you were aware of that. That's the challenge. But that's what Hanslick is essentially saying. Of course, he's speaking at the time this music is coming out for the first time, and the only way you're going to hear it is in a live performance. So, yes, Mr. Watson.
I mean, this is the thing about, you know, not being able to express love itself. I mean, I can think of a point, I mean, in my mind, when I'm, you know, listening to Chopin's, you know, second piano concerto, there's one point where I'm like, he's in love. I mean, at this point, you can see it.
I don't dispute that. And that's my point earlier. We have all done that.
So the music could have been expressing that.
But you don't have any, did Chopin leave a program for that?
No, but I'm pretty sure that he was expressing that.
But this, your issue is a different one. You're speculating in the absence of evidence. We're talking about, in the case of Voltaire, express intention, written by the composer, accompanying the music, intended to be guide the listener. Maybe he wasn't loved, why not? But that is your listener's work. You're doing the listener's work that Schumann said you should do. Don't tell Mr. Weichel what the second Chopin concerto is about. He'll work that out on his own as a listener, and that's fine. But it's a very large step to go from your interpretation of the music to saying, this is what Chopin meant in this passage of today, in the absence of any other control.
But then there's no way for a non-current music without a program to prove that it's impossible to say there's times.
And so what's wrong with just guiding the listener?
Well, according to Schumann, the listener should be able to deal with this on his own. He doesn't need to be guided. And furthermore, according to Hanslick, it is pretentious to claim that flute melodies automatically mean a river. They wouldn't unless you had been told by Ezra Smetana, yes, this is what it is.
But there's plenty of modern music that I can think of, like I wouldn't understand if I didn't have something.
Well, like that. Okay, but here's part of you're absolutely right. There's plenty of modern music you wouldn't understand without being given some guidance as to what the purpose is. But the question is, when you say understand, you mean understand on the composer's terms without being given guidance as to what the composer is doing? Such as to engage with highly dissonant music of the sort that, say, Schoenberg wrote one time, or Bartok. Okay, absolutely right. But I'm here by giving you all permission, by the power vested in me by my age, height, vocal range, and ethnicity, to say, you listen to any music you want to on any terms you want. What I would strongly encourage you all is to be prepared to engage with music of an extraordinary, wide array of affect, including the tension field. Dissonant music comes out of a period of the 20th century, which heaven knows was nothing if not filled with social, political, cultural, ethnic tension. The reason the music of the first half of the 20th century sounds the way it does is because that was the sound of that time. An awful time. The 20th century dripped in blood. And as a consequence, it's not surprising, the music reflects the and Schumann's Symphony for Attention. Basically, it was an extremely elegant reference to the delicate sensibilities of the German who does not want to be told, even by Beethoven, of Lucian music. In more blunt American Anglo-Saxon, he is saying, who the hell do you think you are telling me how to listen to music? And you think you can't get me to listen to that music the way you want me to. You don't have that power as a composer. This is why.
Okay, so it is your stance that, I'm just making sure I'm completely clear about this, that music can reflect emotions such as love, loneliness, and things of that sort, but that it's all the vital listener, but I mean, I just...
Music cannot express, unsimply said, music cannot express the specific emotion of love. It can express the surrounding effects that love can generate, but without it being self-evident that it is love that is the source of the impetuosity, the buoyancy. It could be something else. It could be gas. Yes, but maybe the composer has tried that. Huntley is saying, you can't do it. Try as you might. You cannot communicate a specific emotion. Music cannot convey a specific emotion. You want to convey an emotion? Oh, that's Andrew being there. You want to tell a story or somebody write a letter? You know, if you want to say love, you want to convey love, write something, write a poem that talks about love. Music can't do that. There are other arts that can do it. It doesn't have to be that music carries all the blood for man's emotional expression, aesthetic expression. I mean, you may want it to, but it can't. That's what he's saying. Composers may want to believe they can. I mean, Strauss went so far as to say you can compose a piece of furniture, you can compose a piece of music describing a piece of furniture. Thank you. We're going to go to Central Europe. All of us here. Okay? Without leaving your seats, without passports. Because what I want to do, and one thing I've been studying history, I think is very important. Very important. Is to have the realization that names and places do exist.
Maybe thank you.
All of the rivers in America, they're genuine. important fortification. Because it looked over the river from the south, and as you know, it's easy to flow with a river upstream, downstream. And here it is, right here. You can see it's fortified. There is no fortress now, that's long since been taken away. There is a church which is casting a long shadow around a cemetery in which are buried the cultural heroes of Prague, of the Czech Republic, of Bohemia. So let's take a look. This is the Vltava from central Prague. It is flowing toward us, in effect. We are looking south. I direct your attention to the very small spires right here. They are of that church that cast the shadow over the cemetery on the Vieta. When we get from another perspective, the Vieta is right here. And there is that church with the cemetery. When we go into the that area with the fortifications, one can look down on the river. Here is the Vltava flowing from the south to the north, flowing toward us, and this is one of those ramparts of the Vltava. Looking straight down, you see the edge of the corner, another one, right down on the river. Inside, as I said, is a cemetery for the cultural heroes of Bohemia and the Czech Republic. And here we have, though it is not entirely clear in this exposure, the tomb of Vezli Smetana. If we look here, we see his birth day, month, and year. It takes a while to sort this out. But the way the Czechs do it is the month is the first upper number of the fraction. He was born in 1824, and he was born on the 3rd of February. He died in 1884 on the 5th of May. I should say that the day is the first at the top, and the month is below. The 12th of May, 1884. About 50 feet away, the tomb of Antoni Dvorak, the second generation of Czech nationals. Now, if we back out of the close in focus, and let me go back just once more. And you can do this yourselves as you're listening to Vltava with your computer in hand. You can follow the river. You can start well to the south. The countryside that it's flowing through. And drag it to Prague, where the story of the Vltava. This is a real river. It flows through the heart of what is now the Czech Republic, what was then the western part of the Czech Republic, Bohemia. Just as the Mississippi, for many, is a defining river for American culture and history, so too the Vltava for the Czechs. Thus, Smetana's connection to the river is a connection to place. The poem, the program he presents, support of his music is intended to evoke the countryside of his native land at a time when Bohemia was subservient to Austria, subservient to the Austro-Hungarian. Thank you very much.